The headlines this hour: clashes between police and demonstrators in Paris during a protest against the killing of three Kurds in the French capital. President Putin calls on Russian defense industry to increase its weapons production to meet the needs of the army for the war in Ukraine. Heavy snow in Japan kills at least 13 people and leaves more than 10,000 households without power. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. In France, clashes have erupted between police and protesters one day after three people of a Kurdish community are killed in the capital, Paris. Police used tear gas to disperse the protesters who hurled rocks to vent their anger. Protesters demand answers over the killings and support and protection from the government. The gun attack happened on Friday at a Kurdish cultural center and a nearby cafe. Investigations are underway. Police have arrested a 69-year-old man. He is known to have a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially the Kurds. The Russian president urges the country's defense industry to increase its production to meet the needs of forces fighting in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has told the industry's chiefs to make sure that the army receives the military equipment in the shortest possible time. He made the remarks during a visit to a weapon manufacturing center. Putin also said the industry should prove the technical quality of the equipment. This comes as Western countries, especially the U.S., have been supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of advanced weapons since the beginning of the war in February. The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. The military and economic assistance is part of a $1.6 trillion government funding bill that has passed the Senate. It will now go to U.S. President Joe Biden to be signed into law. The U.S. has been Ukraine's main military sponsor in the war with Russia. It has already sent aid worth around $50 billion to Ukraine this year. Russia has repeatedly warned that foreign military aid for Ukraine will only drag out the war and escalate the human suffering. The war in Ukraine has plunged Moscow-Washington ties to their lowest point in decades. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. has compared the state of the relations to an ice age, warning of the high risk of a clash.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kiev had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO.
Is the UK having Brexit buyer's remorse, or is the departure from the European Union delivering? The country in its longest recession on record, Britons are starting to examine the real consequences of leaving the EU. Syed Purisa reports.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
we will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Sai Puriza, London.
China says it is resolutely opposed to a new U.S. law that boosts military assistance for Taiwan. Beijing says the law contains provisions that causes serious damage to peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Taipei, however, has welcomed the legislation, which will provide it with $10 billion in security aid. Taiwan says the U.S. move shows the importance that Washington attaches to ties with the island and its security. Taiwan has been a source of tension between China and the U.S. for years. That is because the U.S. continues to supply arms to the island, which China considers its own territory. Beijing says Washington's assistance emboldens Taipei in its independence push. In a call between the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, he accused the U.S. of attempting to suppress China's development. He warned Washington against trying to challenge China's red lines using salami-slicing tactics.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the U.S. of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating. As Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan, Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency when anti-China rhetoric began were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated.
The U.S. sees its hegemony challenged by a quickly emerging superpower that, based on most estimates, is bound to overtake it as the number one economy in the world. Washington has resorted to unorthodox tactics to halt its main rival's growth and progress. Those methods are not received well by China. The U.S. is provoking China militarily while simultaneously trying to draw regional countries into its own sphere and away from China. One hot-button issue is Taiwan.
In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing one-China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the six assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and more recently had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
COVID keeps surging rapidly across China, with daily infections topping 500,000 in a single city alone. Local media in Qingdao say that the eastern city has been seeing between 490 and 530,000 new cases a day. They have cited a city health official but did not specify the period during which the surge took place. The same official has predicted an approaching peak and said infections will rise by 10% at the weekend. Other Chinese cities have also faced a surge in infections ever since the government ended a zero COVID policy this month. Snap lockdowns, lengthy quarantines, and travel curbs have all been lifted. The World Health Organization has expressed concern over the virus surge in China. Heavy snow has left at least 13 people dead in Japan over the last week. Dozens more have been injured. That, according to Japanese public broadcaster NHK. Snowstorms have hit areas across northern, eastern, and western Japan since December 17. Thousands of households have suffered power blackouts. Heavy snow has also caused massive traffic jams, disrupting train and airplane services. Thousands of flights have been canceled in the U.S. as a massive winter storm brings airport operations down to a crawl. Nearly 7,000 flights were canceled on Friday and Thursday, leaving holiday travelers frustrated. The Federal Aviation Administration imposed ground stops and delays to de-ice a number of airport runways as a result of the storms. Some 4,000 U.S. flights were also delayed on Friday. Poor weather conditions have also disrupted railroad travel in the holiday season, forcing the cancellation of dozens of trains. Festivities are underway in Bethlehem, the biblical birthplace of Jesus, and the Palestinian city in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. People have converged on Manger Square, carrying flags and beating drums on Christmas Eve. The square has been decorated with fireworks, light shows, and an illuminating giant tree. The main attraction in Bethlehem is the 4th century Church of the Nativity. That's where Jesus was born, according to Christian tradition. The Christmas season offers measured cheer for Palestinians in the city, which is separated from Al-Quds by an Israeli apartheid barrier. Bethlehem was closed for the last two Christmas seasons because of the COVID pandemic. That reduced the number of tourists. However, this year, the Palestinian tourism minister expects that the number will increase. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we have reached this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication, in which the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, says,
لكنك تقدست أسماؤك، أقسمت أن تملأها من الكافرين من الجنة والناس أجمعين. But you, holy are your names, have sworn that you will fill it with the unbelievers, both jinn and men. وأن تخلد فيها المعاندين. You will place those who stubbornly resist forever therein. وأنت جل ثناؤك قلت مبتدئا. And you, majestic is your eulogy, said through kindness, وتطولت بالإنعام متكرما. And as a favor, أفمن كان مؤمنا كمن كان فاسقا لا يستوون. What is he who has been a believer like him who has been ungodly? They are not equal. About the importance of differentiating between these two groups and the criterion related in this issue, we mentioned the importance of heart that as a result of committing sins, it will be disconnected from Almighty Allah, because it has two roles: receiving the light and giving out the light. And when a person has lost this state of heart, this soundness of the heart, it would be devoid of the power of receiving the divine light. This is the state of inqita' al-qalb. The Almighty Allah says, صُمٌّ بُكْمٌ عُمْيٌ فَهُمْ لَا يَرْجِعُونَ. Deaf, dumb, and blind, and they will not come back to the right path. A deaf and blind person, of course, such a person is unable to receive any call or light, and he is unable to speak as well. So, this is what happens to that kind of heart if you are not from among the believers, if you are fasiq, if you have committed sins and you have not repented, if you are still continuing, persisting in your committing sins. So there are some factors that cause the obscurity of the heart, and this is what eventually differentiates between these two groups. لا يستبون, this verse says, they are not the same.
And had you not decreed your enemies to remain in hell, you would have made hell cool and peaceful, and there would never have been an abode or place for anyone in it. But sanctified be your name, you have sworn to fill hell with the disbelievers from amongst the jinns and mankind together, and to place forever your enemies therein. And you, exalted be your praises, have made manifest out of your generosity and kindness that a believer is not like he who is a non-believer.
Paradise, oh what a feeling, paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good. About all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So this is what the Holy Quran says about fasiqeen. They are not like the believers, because let us come up with an example here. A stone, it cannot receive any light, air, or water. It rejects all that comes toward it of these things, and subsequently, it does not give out any fruit. This isn't contrary to that kind of fertile soil which produces fruits as a result of what it receives of light, air, and water, and other minerals. Similarly, this is how the heart becomes if its spiritual soundness is lost. It does not receive any light, it cannot give out any, and this is the state of complete obscurity, this is the state of complete inqita. This is the state of dead heart. Now, tell me, أَفَمَنْ كَانَ مُؤْمِنًا كَمَنْ كَانَ فَاسِقًا لَا يَسْتَوُونَ. They are not the same, they're different. This is the state in which the heart has lost all signs of life, because the life of the heart is depending on what it receives and what it gives out. So when it is not having this feature, it is devoid of life. Regarding the death of the heart, the Allah says, indeed, Allah makes whomever He wishes to hear, and you cannot make those who are in the graves hear. So this man that is starting to get closer to being a fasiq, cannot hear completely the divine calls. The flaw is not in the strength of the call or in its delivery. He has done some things that now he is unable to hear because he is dead. It is in the ability of the dead to hear. This is the flaw. This is exactly the state of obscurity of the heart. And this is the state of disconnection from Allah, the Exalted. Now, this is one possible explanation of أَفَمَنْ كَانَ مُؤْمِنًا كَمَنْ كَانَ فَاسِقًا لَا يَسْتَوُونَ. Is he who has been a believer like him who has been ungodly? They're not equal. And this is all aside from the kind of result the Almighty Allah has set and prepared for mu'min and fasiq. All things we discussed throughout these couple of programs and episodes up to now about the differentiation between mu'min and fasiq, they are all from the aspect of their innate result. We're not discussing the kinds of chastisement and blessing the Almighty Allah has prepared for the fasiq and mu'min. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has been quoted as saying that migration from nations in Africa will end if countries like France stopped exploiting the continent's people and natural resources. The remarks made before she became prime minister have ignited anger in Paris. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the fallout between France and Italy of African migrants entering Europe through the Mediterranean Sea. Italian officials believe that continued plundering of African countries by France is the reason for the flow of illegal migrants from Africa. The second part of our program will be on renewed fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo amid accusations between Kigali and Kinshasa over who is responsible for the upsurge in rebel attacks. Our experts will give us their incisive analysis of these topics, and you can be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Italy slams French colonialism in Africa. A video of Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni condemning French economic imperialism in Africa during an interview she gave to an Italian TV in January 2019 has recently re-emerged and received much praise both in Europe and Africa. The viral video came amid tensions between Italy and France over a migrant rescue ship. Italy's policy of keeping its ports closed to ships carrying rescued migrants has raised tensions between Rome and Paris.
Italy's new government barred the Ocean Viking ship from docking with 230 migrants. France termed the move as unacceptable behavior, but Italy insists it's been taking in its share of migrants. The Italian Prime Minister blasted the response by France, describing it as incomprehensible and unjustified.
I've been very much struck by the French government's aggressive reaction, which from my point of view is incomprehensible and unjustified. Almost 90,000 people have entered Italy since the start of the year. On the same day of our discussions about the Ocean Viking, 600 people arrived in small boats. But for 234 people, they've made diplomatic relations blow up.
Now, for more on the latest part between Italy and France over African migrants, we contacted Don DeBer, an activist and commentator. Thanks for your time today. Now, was the Italian Prime Minister justified in saying migration from Africa would stop if countries like France halted exploitation of the continent's valuable resources?
Well, this is true of the immigration waves around the world. It's the same situation here with the massive immigration from Central and South America and the Caribbean. People are following their stuff basically to the empire. In the case of Africa, Africa's been looted by Europe, 500 years now. And the things that were built with the wealth of Africa and on the back of African labor, both Africans working in Africa and Africans that were stolen and dragged off, either by force or by, market force, to build, these wonderful cities on a hill. That's where all their wealth is. So they're going there too to try to have some of it. That's an absolutely correct statement. France, as a matter of fact, is one of the, next to the U.S. and the U.K., one of the worst offenders. And as a matter of fact, has been recapturing its colonies in the last 10, 15 years.
The French-Italian feud is the latest episode in the standoff over where to disembark refugees, picked up after trying to reach Europe from North Africa. In 2019, the then-Italian Deputy Prime Minister, Luigi Di Maio, accused France of continuing to colonize Africa and causing people to migrate from the continent.
There are dozens of African countries where France is printing a currency of its own, the franc of the colonies. And with that currency, French debt is financed. If France didn't have African colonies, which it's impoverishing, it would be the 15th world economic power.
It appears there are deep-rooted differences between Italy and France in Africa. The spat between Rome and Paris is seen by many as rivalry between two European powers that colonized African countries.
Imputing intent is a fool's errand. But the history of Italy in Africa is distinct from the history of France, certainly. and of some other colonial powers. Italy was, in the modern age, mostly confined to the northeastern part of Africa and the eastern, you know, the Horn, particularly Ethiopia and Libya. And Libya, as a matter of fact, is like 400 kilometers from Sicily, from, you know, from Italy, across the Mediterranean. But the critique is correct. Even as France was kicked out as the colonial power nominally, they preserved the right to print the currency for these countries. In other words, the economy of each of these countries was still entirely in the hands of Paris.
Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni said in Rome recently that Italy can lead in EU-Africa cooperation. Now, she claimed that Italy will pursue a non-predatory but collaborative posture. Now, can African countries really trust Italy, which appears to indicate that it has the continent's interests at heart?
Italy has Italy's interests at heart. You can only hope that the leaders of Italy have at least that much. You know, the Africans have their own interests at heart. And the proof, you know, whatever deal someone brings to Africa, whether it's good or bad for Africa, will be determined by people in Africa and by Africans. You know, they will test who's a good partner and an honest partner and who's not as they engage and as they have engaged. There is competition now. Before, you had the United States, you had European countries, which are under the military occupation of the United States. That was basically it. And the relationship was essentially they come there with guns. They point the guns at the people. They tell them, go into the mines and bring us all the stuff, put it on our boats, and then they leave. And they come back for more when the boat's empty. So what Italy intends to do or doesn't intend to do, you know, you can go all the way back to Carthage and look at the relationship. I mean, there's a lot of contradictions there. But what matters is that Africans have agency that is protected by the world community to make up their own mind about what's good or not good for them and to act accordingly.
The vast majority of Africans attempting the Mediterranean crossing to Europe pass through Libya. Now, Italy and France were both involved in NATO's military intervention in Libya that destabilized the country and created the current migrant crisis. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah. Right now, Libya is basically a failed state with various factions competing for power. And the United States, you have the CIA backs one faction, the Pentagon backs another. This kind of disruption in people's lives, the disruption in labor markets in Europe, the disruption in, you know, the lives of people in Africa, there are some people who make money on all of it. And they're making policy in the United States, and they're making policy in Brussels as well for the EU. And so this, I mean, the solution is going to be to stabilize all of the places where, you know, the empires created chaos, basically, let people sit still where they are and repair and rebuild their homes and, you know, their towns and all the things that keep being destroyed by, you know, U.S. bombings and terrorist attacks and such that are financed by the West. And just let people live their own lives. That'll solve the problem.
More than 50,000 people worldwide have lost their lives during their migratory journeys since the International Organization of Migration started documenting deaths in its Missing Migrants Project in 2014. Africa is the second deadliest region for people on the move, with more than 9,000 deaths during migration documented on the continent since 2014. Leading Pan-Africanist PLO Lumumba says African migrants are compelled to take the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean because African countries are weak.
I watched a woman from Nigeria who had been rescued from the Mediterranean around Lampedusa say, "I will not go back to Africa. Even if I die in the Mediterranean, I'll try again and again." What is it that can make a human being say that I do not want to go back to my home? Because the natural instinct of a human being should be that you want to go home. It's because we are weak
Now, what, in your opinion, is a solution that will reduce the flow of African economic migrants to Europe?
They've weaponized the poor people by sending them out of their own homes, blowing up their homes, basically, in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And people move to places where there's jobs and homes and other things that you need to live. And this depresses labor markets and changes the entire political configuration and creates chaos in everybody's lives except for the people that sit on top. And so, you know, whatever solution is done, the real solution is to stop destroying people's homes, stop starving them with sanctions, stop making war on them, stop backing terrorists, etc. Just leave people alone and let them do business with the things that they have, and people will be fine. They'll figure the rest of it out.
Well, there you have it. If Western countries stop spreading wars and plundering other countries, the problem of illegal migration will be solved. I'd like to thank our guest, Don DeBar, for his insight. Let's now take a short break before we turn our attention to the upsurge of deadly violence in the mineral-rich eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
Rising tensions in the DRC.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Hundreds of people have been killed over the last few weeks in the Democratic Republic of Congo in attacks blamed on the M23 rebel group. Now, the killing of innocent civilians started just days after the announcement of a fragile ceasefire agreement.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo repeatedly accuses neighboring Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels, an accusation that Rwanda regularly denies. In a bid to stop the violence in the mineral-rich eastern DRC, the East African Community decided to deploy troops in one of its member states for the first time in June 2022. The deployment in the Democratic Republic of the Congo will test the regional body's ability to respond to complex conflicts.
Meanwhile, the people of Eastern DRC have been holding protests following increased attacks by the M23 rebels.
Our fellow citizens were killed by the M23 terrorists, and the president declared 3 days of national mourning.
It's too much. We've had enough. We don't want war. We are here for peace. Congolese people want peace, but our neighbors don't want to give it to us.
Now to discuss the ongoing violent conflict in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Claude Gatebuke. He's the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Gatebuke is also the co-author of the book Survivors Uncensored. Thanks for your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's the reason for the upsurge of insecurity in the eastern part of DRC, where many civilians have been killed?
You know, the basic reason for the violence in the Congo, and it's constant there, and that is the riches of the Congo. The Congo is the richest country in natural resources. It has over $24 trillion, or an estimated $24 trillion worth of resources in its soil. So there is a scramble for resources in the Congo by multinationals around the globe, mostly Western multinationals. And then to be able to access it, the West has decided that it's best to use its local mercenaries to invade the Congo, create insecurity, and plunder and loot the resources of the Congo.
Former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is the East African Community mediator in the DRC. Speaking early December in Nairobi on progress made in the latest round of talks aimed at securing peace in eastern DRC, he called on all foreign troops to leave the country.
I want to say the problem of foreign groups engaging in Congo and leaving destruction. I have taken it up with the leadership of the East African Community. And the same groups need to engage with their governments and leave Congo in peace.
53 armed groups from the Democratic Republic of Congo that met in Kenya for the third East African Community-led Nairobi peace process have agreed to lay down their arms as Kinshasa. There is a lot of skepticism if this fragile agreement will finally bring sustainable peace to the DRC.
I wish I could say that peace is finally coming to the DRC, but at the end of the day, in order for the DRC to have lasting peace, there has to be truth and there has to be justice. And justice in the DRC will have to start with the crimes documented in the UN mapping exercise report that was published by the UN and is now collecting dust at the UN for the last 12 years. And that document, that report, 600 pages almost, over 600 incidents, major atrocities committed in the Congo for a period of 10 years. And then since then, there has been even more. Until there is justice on those crimes, there is not going to be lasting peace in the Congo. And that type of justice is going to have to take on US, UK, European Union allies.
President Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Felix Tshisekedi of the DRC have exchanged harsh words and blamed each other for backing rebel groups. Now, do you think tensions between the two leaders will jeopardize the fragile truce reached in Nairobi?
There is no fragile truce. Just in the last week, the last couple of weeks, there were massacres of hundreds of people in areas occupied by the Rwandan military in the Congo. They call themselves the M23. But it's M23 rebels, but it's the Rwandan troops and the Ugandan troops that are backing them. They committed massacres of hundreds of civilians. So exchanging words, when they weren't exchanging words, there was no truce. They were still killing people. The invasions were still happening. So it's not about the war of words. I think the clarity is actually important. At some point, the world has to accept the fact that what is happening in the Congo is not internal rebellions, and we can stop pretending and we can talk about the reality of Rwanda and Uganda invading Congo.
Well, amid the upsurge in rebel attacks in eastern DRC, anti-United Nations protests have been held several times. Most of these protests have taken place in the streets of the city of Goma against the country's UN mission known as the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Residents accuse the UN mission, known by its French acronym MONUSCO, of failing to stop armed groups' decades-old fighting.
We've been watching the UN mission since the start. They have the logistical capacity they need. What are they doing with that? This is why we need to kick them out.
UN peacekeeping forces have failed to restore peace in the DRC, and now East African countries have deployed troops in eastern DRC. Foreign forces in eastern DRC have come under sharp criticism for failing to stop the massacre of civilians.
Let me start with the UN peacekeeping or so-called peacekeeping mission. They've been there for more than 20 years, I believe. Their budget, the last time I checked, was about $1 billion a year. I have to double check that number. It's $1 billion a year, I believe. But they are not engaged in actually stopping the violence. So the way I see it, the UN troops are just a force that's in the Congo as part of one of many who are exploiting the Congolese people, the resources of the Congo, and enriching themselves. The Congo doesn't need more military. In fact, what needs to happen is an arms embargo on the countries that are invading the Congo so that they do not have the weapons to invade the Congo.
In November, irate Congolese citizens burnt European Union flags during a protest in the city of Bukavu in eastern DRC against the M23 rebels. They also blamed Western powers such as the United States, Britain, and France for backing violence in this mineral-rich region.
The population living in the east of the DRC is the victim of multiple attacks by Rwanda and Uganda, with the blessing of the great powers, mainly the United States of America, Great Britain, France, and other countries. Let us express to the whole world our discontent with what we call injustice and international discrimination against the Congolese people that we are.
Western powers, through their regional proxies, have been accused of backing rebels in the DRC with the express objective of continuing the looting of Congo's minerals. Now, is the notorious M23 rebel group indirectly backed by Western imperialist powers?
Yes, I've said this before. The M23 rebel group, which is the deadliest in the Congo today and in yesteryears, which is also a reincarnation of multiple other previous rebel groups, is an extension of Western imperialism and Western neocolonialist policy in the region.
Our guest there says Western powers are backing the M23 rebel group that has killed thousands of Congolese civilians over the last few years in the mineral-rich Eastern DRC. Our time is up. We shall keep our eyes on the situation in the Eastern DRC and give you in-depth analysis on this conflict. I'd like to thank Claude Gachabuke for his time today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Drop us a line through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.